Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our show today, we continue our look at road funding for Michigan. There's a new proposal out this week in the State House that would shift the way we pay for road and bridge repairs. But could it pass with both Democrat and Republican support? And later in the show, it's true. Everything old is new again. We're going to talk with a Michigan man who's trying to revive the cassette tape. But first, the so-called Senate Gang of Eight have released their immigration reform proposal. The formal introduction of the bipartisan bill, known officially as the Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act of 2013, was filed last night, early this morning, as most of us slept, at 2 a.m. The legislation, all 844 pages of it, would enact sweeping changes in the nation's immigration laws. President Obama says the bill is a compromise that doesn't give everyone everything they want, but he's urging the Senate to move forward with it. So let's look now at the man who likes to call himself the nation's most pro-immigration governor, and that would be our governor, Republican Rick Snyder. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, was with the governor this afternoon. And Rick, what did the governor have to say about the introduction of this bill?
I will also point out that if you suggest to the governor that he considers himself the most pro-immigration governor in the country, he will correct you and say, no, I am the most pro-immigration governor in the country. And it is a topic that he is passionate about. And, you know, we've heard a lot coming into this about border security and a path to citizenship. And certainly we have a lot of undocumented immigrants here in Michigan. But what the governor was focused on was the desire of a lot of business people. And remember, his background is business.
Certainly.
To lift the cap on a couple of work visas, and those would be the H-1B visa and the EB-5 visa. And these two visas are visas for entrepreneurs and investors. They're not cheap. It costs money to get them. But the idea is that if you could lift the cap and encourage more of those investors to come and locate here, that you could do good things for the economy, that there are studies that show that immigrants are risk takers. And it makes sense because, you know, they're willing to uproot themselves and move to a new country. And they're risk takers who are more likely than the indigenous population to do things like start a business. And once they start a business, they will employ people. And what Governor Snyder says is that, you know, we sort of have a whole lot of people who might be interested in that. And there's a significant pool of candidates that we call college students.
I've been promoting this for years, is to say, let's look at the students that come over and get a master's degree or PhD in science, technology, engineering, and math. We've got a system today that in large part says we're going to help give you a world-class education, the best in the world, and then we tell you to get out. How dumb is that? The realities are we should be giving those individual green cards. Again, we should do the background checks and everything else, but they should be getting a green card because they're going to create jobs. And there's strong evidence to show that. If you look at Silicon Valley, a huge percentage of the startups there have a foreign national as one of the founders. You look at the patent database, the evidence is all there. This is just something that needs to take place.
So when the governor talks about reinventing Michigan, I mean, this is part of it, that you look at some of his initiatives, that, you know, the Detroit Bridge, this idea that Michigan becomes the centerpiece of a North American trade zone that stretches from St. Louis to Montreal.
Okay.
That we get more highly educated workers, and this speaks directly to that. But you know, one of the things, I mean, part of the anguish of Michigan's lost decade was Michiganders mourning the loss of sure thing employment, that, mm-hmm. that you walk out of high school, you walk into a factory, that they train you and you have a job.
You're good till you retire.
And you're good until you retire. And that and instead, what the governor wants is a more entrepreneurial culture where people start not, you know, I mean, maybe they'll become businesses, but instead of expecting employment at a big company with factories, that maybe you'll be employed by a smaller startup entrepreneurial firm, or or maybe you'll be employed by one of those firms. And when you talk about Michigan's history and when you talk about Michigan's business history and employment history, he'll say, you look at a lot of our big companies and they were started either by immigrants or by the children of immigrants.
We need to turn around the psychology. If you look at what helped Michigan become a great state, it was immigrants. We built companies like Masco and Meijer and Dow and places like that that really are foundational that now we take for granted as Michigan companies. They were started by immigrants.
That all sounds real good. Rick, how much influence do you think Governor Snyder really has in this national debate, in this national conversation?
Well, he was part of a coalition that was really spearheaded by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he started something. It's called the Partnership for a New American Economy. The Partnership for a New American Economy, you could find it on the web. It's got a website. And it's specifically directed at the need to encourage, entrepreneurial immigrants or entrepreneurial foreigners mm-hmm. to come to the United States instead of to going to other countries to invest and start businesses.
And bring their ideas.
Mm-hmm. Bring their ideas and bring their money. Like I said, these visas are not cheap, but these are people with – if they've got the resources to start companies, then they've got the resources to get these visas as long as they're available for them. And then what the governor hopes is that Michigan will be a particularly – welcoming place for immigrants. One of the things that he's talked about is a program in Michigan that would be sort of like a welcome wagon for immigrants, that when someone from another country comes and locates here, that economic development officials will help match them up with other people, other immigrants from that country, so that they'll find a welcoming, comfortable culture for them to operate in.
So, Rick, we've got about 600,000 immigrants in Michigan, most of them living here legally, and then it's believed there's up to 150,000 undocumented immigrants in Michigan. So what does this all mean for them?
Well, it depends on how and why they're here. We just spent a lot of time talking about using visas to attract entrepreneurs, to attract investors. Also, the state wants to attract high-tech workers. We know that as the economic recovery continues and hopefully speeds up, mm-hmm. that there's going to be a need for skilled high-tech workers. And but there is also another category of worker, and this will particularly matter in West Michigan, in agriculture, and also in tourism. And these aren't high-tech, high-skilled jobs. These are low-skill, low-wage jobs doing agricultural harvesting, things like that, immigrants play a big part in Michigan's tourism industry. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there is a whole we could have a whole separate discussion on the sub-economy that goes along the I-75 corridor from Florida to Michigan
yes.
that takes care of immigrants who come to the state to do seasonal work. And these aren't people who want to live in Michigan or want to live in the United States. What they want is easy access across the border.
Being able to bring their families.
They want to be able to bring their families. But this gets directly to these issues regarding border security mm-hmm. because that requires the border to be porous, for it to be easily passable. And also because these are low-wage jobs, that these guest worker visas need to be affordable for the people who need them to come do seasonal work in Michigan, seasonal work in the United States, and then, as is their desire, return to their home country.
Now, it's interesting to note, meantime, there certainly appears to be a push for immigration reform among business leaders in Michigan. You've got a group there that's pretty favorable of Governor Snyder and his policies. In fact, yesterday, Rich Studley, who's CEO and president of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, said the state needs to be more encouraging to immigrants. So it sounds like they're all picking up the same tune.
Well, they are. I mean, you know, the governor, you know, is of and from that business community.
Right.
And he really does represent their interests and thinking in terms of things like this. And so what you're hearing from groups like the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, the Detroit mm-hmm. Regional Chamber, Business Leaders for Michigan, is that immigrants can help Michigan fill that skills gap that exists in our workforce and that will hopefully, you know, help turn around our economy. And also, if you look at, you know, the research of, you know, urban scholars like Richard Florida, they also say that that urban renewal depends on an area being welcoming to immigrants, because those are the people who are going to come in and fill the spaces that have been left by others. And so, you know, that you know, when you talk about cool cities, and mm-hmm. you know, we hear a lot of talk about artists going and filling that urban pioneers coming in and
yep.
living there, and a robust immigration policy that encourages that also helps restore cities.
One final thought, Rick. It's kind of interesting to see this with Governor Snyder jumping into this national debate, because he rarely weighs in on national issues.
he likes to say that he's focused on other things and doesn't weigh in on national issues. And as is often the case with politicians, that's only true when he doesn't want to weigh in on national issues. This is one that he wants to weigh in on.
Rick Pluto, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Pleasure to have you actually in the studio.
And
thanks.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The collapse of Detroit, the appointment by Governor Snyder of Emergency Manager Kevin Orr, the litany of problems that face Detroit, which include annual cash shortages, complaints by residents that services are not being delivered, police don't respond to calls. All of this has drawn the attention of the world. But surely Detroit is not the first major American city to have to fight its way back from tremendous setbacks and challenges. Case in point, some 30 years ago, back in the early 1980s, Atlanta had the dubious distinction of being the murder capital of America, a troubled city. And that was the time when Andrew Young was running for mayor of Atlanta. Mr. Young, of course, had been a close friend of Dr. Martin Luther King, a leader in the civil rights movement. He'd served in the U.S. Congress, then served as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And then at the urging of Coretta Scott King, among others, Andrew Young ran for mayor of Atlanta in 1981. And during his two terms, the city saw a true rebirth. Andrew Young recently spoke in Detroit, part of the Michigan Black Chamber of Commerce's celebration of Black History Month. Ambassador Young explored the ways Detroit could learn from Atlanta. And Ambassador Andrew Young joins us now from Atlanta. Welcome to Stateside, sir.
Well, thank you, and it's good to be talking with you.
Well, with your sense of history, which is so important and something that is often forgotten, the sense of history and perspective as news stories unfold, I'm wondering, what have your thoughts been as you've watched Detroit erode to the point now where it's under state emergency management?
Well, you know, Michael Burke with the Obama campaign was in Atlanta, and he raised the question, why didn't Detroit do what Atlanta did? And I said that it was really a different history, and it turned out that our bad history ended up being a blessing.
How so?
In the sense that in the 40s and 50s, the mayor bought a huge plot of land for $95,000 to build an airport. He invited Delta to come in, and he gave them all the land they needed for a dollar a year for 50 years. And he put up red lights on Peachtree Street, and he got voted out of office. That was too progressive, and Mr. Woodruff of Coca-Cola and others in the business community realized that Atlanta had to grow, and they decided that there just were not enough progressive white people in town to move the city forward. So they went out to Morehouse and Spelman, and they created a coalition between the business community and the black academic community, which then was expanded to include the preachers. And the labor unions back then in the South were segregated.
Mm-hmm.
So they were part of the opposition to change at that time. In Detroit, labor was the progressive part of the coalition. But I think that while we were forced to be in partnership with the business community, and everything we did pretty much together. We built our airport, and it didn't cost us anything. We put together a tax-exempt municipal bond issue, and we sold $300 million worth of bonds, and we built the first major expansion in our airport. While I was mayor, we probably issued another close to $1 billion worth of tax-exempt bonds. Now, we've never had to pay for them, and nothing we did cost the taxpayers any money because we used, we used creative capitalism.
Hmm.
It's what I call public purpose capitalism. Anytime I knew there was no money, and I knew there was no money in Washington by the time I got to be mayor, but I also knew that there was surplus capital all over the world that was looking for a place to invest that was safe, that was honest, and that was efficient. And I started going around the world telling people, if you're going to be in business, you've got to be in the American market, and the best place to operate from is Atlanta.
So Detroit could do the same thing.
Detroit could do the same thing. And actually, you have a bigger market within 500 miles of Detroit, and you've got Canada.
I'm speaking with Ambassador Andrew Young, who these days is the chairman of the Andrew J. Young Foundation. He recently spoke in Detroit about his experiences as the mayor of Atlanta, offering thoughts about what Detroit could learn from Atlanta's turnaround. So you're saying thinking globally while acting locally is what the key
exactly.
is.
Exactly. In fact, that's our problem in our nation. All politics is local, but all economics is global. And actually, I knew that there was no money locally. There was no way I could pass a bond issue hardly in the beginning. But I could convince petrodollars in Holland that they were not, at least the Swiss banks were charging people interest to keep their money. And I said, you don't have to pay interest for your money. You can invest it in Atlanta. And if you invest it in Atlanta, we will assure you that it's safe, that it's honest, and that it's efficient. We bought 1,100 businesses in here in 8 years. Now, that was in the Reagan years when there was not much money available from the government, and we never got anything from the state government.
Hmm.
But so Atlanta plugged into becoming a part of the global economy. We bypassed Washington. We bypassed the state government. Well, I don't know. We have to reimagine Detroit. But your sports teams do well. The automobile industry is coming back, but you got to get the business community involved in the city of Detroit.
So you had to create and then sell to people around the world a new image of Atlanta.
Well, we did, and so we first of all had to change our image, and we did that with little motor scooters. And when I was in Congress, We learned that you have to have a police presence, and they can't be in automobiles. So we put police on these little motor scooters on the sidewalk going around downtown. And it gave people a sense of comfort. So we decided that we were going to, we plotted our crime. We had a... One of my policemen in my office was working on a master's degree in criminology at Georgia State. So I suggested to him and let him do it on my time he'd make a computerized map of all the crimes over the last 3-4 years. And then based on where the crimes were occurring, we decide how we were going to keep them from occurring there in the future. So we went real technocrat on crime prevention, and one of the things that I think helped us was that we had a woman who was a deputy chief of police who was, well, very sensitive to the community. Everybody liked her. And we, frankly, we had two black PhDs running our police force. So it was a rather cerebral, intellectual approach to crime, but it worked.
And could that be applied, sir, to the situation in Detroit where resources and money is virtually not there?
Well, see, we hadn't spent any money. That didn't take any money. That just took thought and brains and dedicating the resources that we had and dedicating them more precisely. And so when we knew where all the crimes were coming, we then, under Chief Lee Brown, we started what he started what we call community policing, so that the police would have meetings with the community. After we identified these high-crime communities, the police zone went out, and we had a series of community meetings where the community people told us how they wanted their community protected and where they cooperated and where we organized Neighborhood Watch. And we got the community involved in crime. We also got the schools, and we had the police athletic league at the playgrounds, and we got the business community to give us some, well, really, they were basketball shelters. They were nothing but a slab of concrete with a roof on it, and but it had lights. And so kids could play basketball. We had a midnight basketball league, we called it. But it was run under the auspices of the police athletic league. So we got the police and the community involved in recreation and other things. And I was really surprised at the response.
And finally, sir, when I was looking at the website for your Andrew J. Young Foundation, I saw a phrase that struck me, and that was the phrase, effective servant leadership. Knowing that Detroiters are going to vote for a mayor and city council members this November, what's the challenge that you would issue to whomever wins those races, to Detroit's leaders?
The first thing we have to do is decide who you're going to vote for. And I would say that of all the cities in the world, Detroit, with the automobile industry, with the educational system in Michigan, with the infrastructure that you have there in terms of rails and roads and things, that there are not many better places in the world to do business if you create a favorable business climate. You know, you've got to develop a reputation, and it's simple. I used to let everybody, I said, look, you don't have to have appointment to see the mayor if you're an investor. Just come anytime is convenient to you. If I'm there, I'll stop what I'm doing, and it doesn't take but 10 minutes. And I can stop almost any meeting for 10 minutes for somebody who wants to move a factory into town. And let me go back to say that the first thing that has to turn around is your own attitude towards yourself. And mm-hmm. Detroit, as long as I can remember, has been beaten up on itself. I have a lot of friends in Detroit. And actually, we've lured a lot of Detroit's talents down here. And with Michigan State, with Wayne State, with the churches that you have in Detroit, I think that it's a matter of massive community organization. But it has to start with organizing the finances. And I think that's what you have to create a sense of confidence and accountability. Detroit isn't going anywhere. It really is a nice city.
Well, we appreciate your time today, sir. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Andrew Young, former ambassador, former congressman, former mayor of Atlanta, and today he's the chairman of the Andrew J. Young Foundation. And now on to the Restaurant Opportunities Center of Michigan, strengthening the city of Detroit from the ground up and building a better life for restaurant workers. That is the mission of Rock Michigan, part of a nationwide movement to create fair and just working conditions for restaurant workers. Rock Michigan's research finds that workers of color tend to be concentrated in the lowest paying jobs in the restaurant industry, and they're the ones most likely to have their rights violated. One way to help these workers of color move up the pay and prestige scale is through Colors Detroit, a project of the Restaurant Opportunities Center of Michigan. Colors is a restaurant in the heart of downtown Detroit, but it's not just any restaurant. It's a restaurant with a real mission. Joining me here in the studio is Chef Phil Jones. He's head chef and general manager of Colors. It's located in the Paradise Valley area of downtown Detroit. You may remember that as Harmony Park, right near the Detroit Opera House. Welcome, Chef. It's very good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So explain to us, as the head chef and general manager, how is Colors a restaurant and more?
Well, Colors is actually a program run by the Restaurant Opportunity Center of Michigan. Our parent organization is the Restaurant Opportunity Center United out of New York, which was formed shortly after 9/11. It was formed in response to people needing jobs. Along the way, the phone started ringing. Found out there are a lot of abuses in the restaurant industry. There's wage issues, wages being stolen. There's racial discrimination, people of color in the back, people of the majority in the front, sexual harassment, unsafe working conditions, and a litany of issues that are rarely addressed because we don't see it. It's behind doors. And that's what it is. It's a lot of abuse that you don't see and you don't experience because to you it's just dinner.
You're coming out and you're having dinner, you're paying your bill, and you leave.
Basically.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of violations of civil rights and human rights in the restaurant industry. So the phone started ringing and started answering the calls and found that they needed an organization that answered these issues. And so that's where the Restaurant Opportunity Center came in. We are the second Colors in the Rock family, and while we're not worker-owned, we like to say we're worker-focused. And a couple of the programs that we have several ways in, mm-hmm. one of which is called the Earn and Learn program, where we assist in getting people their uniforms, give them soft skill training such as resume writing, interview skills, teach them some life skills that some people might not have actually been exposed to at some point in time.
Sure.
And then they get hands-on in a restaurant, which is the most important part of the experience, because how can you go for a job if you've never done it?
So it's kind of like an incubator.
Yes,
in a
very
sense,
much so.
To help these workers, like you say, learn this whole array of skills, from life skills to resume writing to how to be a good waiter or a good kitchen worker, whatever it takes.
Yes. We have a lot of different stories as the way people come to us. We get people, this is their first job experience. 18-year-olds have never had to work or have never been inspired to work. We've got incarcerated citizens that are returning citizens that need help, and because there are a lot of issues getting people hired that have been in the prison system.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who want to change careers. And so in Michigan, the hospitality industry is actually growing. It was one of the few, if not the only, industry that is growing. So we're trying to assist people in getting those jobs.
So in a sense, I'm hearing that workers are getting trained in an atmosphere that's supportive, where some of these abuses that you talk about that are pretty endemic in the food industry, restaurant industry, aren't happening. So you get you're getting a good start.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about justice, and instead of just talking about it, we're showing it. And you know, to show that you can be a well-maintained restaurant and not abuse folks and not take advantage of folks is our main goal. And also, we also support local food in a lot of different ways, because if we support the local food economy, mm-hmm. we're helping to create new jobs and finding places for our people to be placed.
So what kinds of things do you offer? If I walked into Colors, what kind of things on the menu would I find?
We like to say that Colors is a place that you eat your lunch that you pass on the way to work. So we actually purchase from a lot of produce that's grown right in the city of Detroit. We have really nice, intimate relationships with our folks, and that's the way that we move forward. It's not big business. It's small businesses, people that you can talk to. You know, you know your farmer, know your food.
Almost very retro, looking back.
Yes, yeah, we've had the answers, but we've moved so fast that we've moved past the proper way forward.
Chef, what are you seeing as far as customers who come into Colors, and what kind of, enlightenment do you see?
A lot of enlightenment is just good food and a good meal. You know, sometimes in justice, you don't have to beat justice about people about their heads with justice. Sometimes you just got to feed them. And, you know, once they get to hear our service stories, talk to the folks, and actually create relationships, a lot of activity comes from that. And it's, especially for someone that's a returning citizen, it's difficult enough for them to get a job, but they come into this supporting, caring environment. it passes along to our customers, and it actually builds up their confidence, because someone that's been incarcerated is not used to being treated humanely. Mm-hmm. Is not being used to being treated as an equal, as a person of worth and of substance. And this happens in our restaurant, and it's a really beautiful process.
The restaurant is Colors, and I've been speaking with Chef Phil Jones, who's the head chef and the general manager of Colors, which is owned by the Restaurant Opportunities Center of Michigan. Chef, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to transportation funding in Michigan. As we know, Governor Snyder has been wanting more than $1 billion just this year to pay for road and bridge repairs. Our state has seriously bad roads. That lawmakers in Lansing appear to agree on. How to pay for repairs? Well, that's a whole other story. We've talked a lot on Stateside about the different options to raise the money for those repairs. For months, the governor's been trying to get support from lawmakers, but we haven't seen a whole lot of movement until possibly now. A State House committee has begun hearings on a road funding strategy. Joining us now is Chris Gouts. He's Capitol correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
So explain the details, as you know them, of this new strategy. How would this work?
Well, in some ways, it's not a new strategy. It seems like everything that is old is new again. And they're coming back to this idea of getting rid of some of the taxes that we all pay at the pump, including the 19 cents we pay in terms of tax per gallon for gasoline and 15 cents for diesel. You would get rid of that. And then on top of that, you would also get rid of the 6% sales tax that we also pay on that purchase. So it's sort of a tax on a tax. And this creates a number of problems and a number of positives, depending on, you know, which side of the pump you're on. And they would replace that revenue in large part with a tax at the wholesale level. And that would be sort of a variable rate that could change every 3 months, based on a certain criteria that the Treasury Department would look at. So it would be different. It would be a floor of like 10.1%, although that could shift a bit. But right now, as the bill is written, it would start out as a 12% tax at the wholesale level. It sounds like one of the positives is that it would seem to lower the price that people would pay at the pump, just because you're getting rid of so many taxes and replacing it with a smaller amount. Not everyone is convinced of that, and I guess we'll see if this sticks, but I think that would be one of the selling points that they would try to make, is that you would actually pay a little bit less at the pump.
But there are some concerns that if this happens, it would mean that local governments and schools could lose, somewhat like upwards of $850 million in funding?
Yeah, that's sort of the rub, is that when the 6% sales tax that I talked about, most people, I think, if they even think about it while they're cursing the high prices they're paying at the pump,
sure.
if they even think about it, you would think that everything that you're paying in tax when you buy gasoline goes to fund roads and do things, you know, of that nature. It actually doesn't. The vast majority of that 6% sales tax goes to schools, goes to local governments, and a few smaller items, I believe. And so of this plan, it's really to try to show people and make sort of a public awareness campaign that is this really how we want to fund schools? That I think the lawmakers think they can make that case. That's really not a good idea. So we've got to get away from that and just have it so that everything you pay at the pump goes to roads. And make that clear distinction and then move forward from there.
Well, that's great for roads, but is anyone talking about a way to make up that lost funding to the schools and local governments? They've already suffered a lot in terms of having funding cut.
Yeah, the one way that there's several ways that you could do it. The way that's talked about right now in the House Transportation Committee is this idea that's come up before that you would go to the ballot and ask voters to increase the sales tax from 6 to 7%, with the proceeds of that going to make up any deficiencies in the school aid fund and local government budgets that these actions would take. The beauty of this is that before, when there was talk of a ballot proposal to raise money for roads or just doing it, the governor's idea of raising, you know, the gas tax in a way, although it was somewhat connected to this whole wholesale tax idea, is that instead of that, you're actually going to be asking the voters to vote to increase the sales tax to give money to schools. and to help your local government keep their firefighters and police officers employed. And who's against that? You know, it's a much easier sell to vote for or against the kids,
yeah,
than to raise your own price at the pumps. So that's a much easier sell. I think ultimately that could be the way that this goes. If you do have to go before the voters, that's probably the way you want to go based on polling.
So, Chris, where do you think this leaves Governor Snyder's proposal, which, of course, centered on higher gas taxes and vehicle registration fees? So where do you think this leaves his plan?
You know, he's always said that you know, I don't know, I think he might even quibble with calling it his plan, although, you know, you have to put something out of the table, and that's what he did. But his basic premise has always been that I want to get something done. We have a $1.2, $1.5 billion problem. I want to fix the problem. If you come to me with a way to solve that problem, you know, that's really still a user fee-based system, you know, that he can likely support that. So the other beauty of this plan is that it would get away from that birthday tax, quote-unquote, idea where it would raise registration fees or raise, you know, the actual gas tax exponentially higher. That you would do away with that. So that leaves some, that is a positive thing. But it's a good step because overall, you know, this is really the first time the lawmakers have really had a hearing on a specific bill related to transportation funding since the governor made this proposal back in February. So it shows progress, but there's still a really long way to go.
And let's talk politics a little bit, Chris. We've certainly seen many Republicans appear very unwilling to vote for any increase in taxes, maybe afraid of that possible primary challenge. Do you think this is something Republicans, of course, they're in the majority, would consider voting for? I mean, it is a plan advanced by a Republican state representative and Representative Wayne Schmidt.
You know, I think that actually you could get support for this. It'll be tough, and you're never going to win. You're never, ever going to win some of these Republicans over who are just never, ever going to attach themselves to anything that looks or smells or walks like a tax increase. But from what I've been hearing, just picking up bits and pieces, I think at the end of the day, this is going to look a lot like how it did in 97 when Republicans under, you know, Republican Governor John Engler last raised the gas tax by 4 cents. And they did that by pairing it with some middle-class tax cuts. So you can mark my words here today. If this does pass, I think in the next few months, you'll likely see it has some tax cuts connected to it to make it more palatable. And if it doesn't, we'll just delete this tape. But I think that's mean, because that's really largely how they got this through in 97. You know, there's all these sorts of charts and graphs that you saw on the front pages of all the newspapers around the state showing how, you know, if you're a family of four that drives X amount per year, the gas tax increase is going to cost you this much. But with the exemptions and the credits that we're going to apply, you know, that help out, you know, children and people with families, you might actually come out on top, or might pay just a relatively minor amount more per year in taxes to get better roads for the entire state. So
those graph makers could start dusting off their skills, huh?
Absolutely. I think that's going to have to come back if you're going to sell this.
Now, as you talk to people in Lansing, Chris Gouts, are you getting a feeling that this could actually be the consensus on funding that folks are looking for, or is this one more proposal that might wither on the vine, or is it too soon to tell?
No, I think this has some legs. I mean, when the chair of a committee puts something forward, it's serious. I mean, this isn't some backbench Democrat who, you know, who doesn't have any power, who's just holding a press conference to you know, offer up a bill that doesn't have any chance of passing. I mean, this is the chairman's show, and then we'll see if this committee can come up with something that the speaker, you know, and ultimately the Senate Majority Leader and the rest of the caucus in the House and the Senate can get behind. But, no, I think that, I mean, like I said before, this is an idea that's sort of been out there. So people are, this isn't something completely new that they're trying to wrap their heads around. It's just the latest iteration. And I think it has some potential.
And Representative Schmidt says a vote could happen in early May. Is it realistic? I suppose the fact that he's the chair of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, he could make that happen, couldn't he?
He could make it happen tomorrow, I suppose, if he wanted to. But I mean, for this to work, it really has to be. I mean, because you need time for this to get, if you talk about early May, that still gives you a few weeks to get it over to the Senate for them to debate it, make any changes, you know, reconcile those and get that to the governor before their self-imposed June 1st deadline of getting the budget done. And that makes it much more complicated because depending on the way this is structured, it could free up general fund money because as it stands now, the state doesn't have enough revenue to make the federal match that brings in even more money for the roads. so they have to use some general fund money. So if you create this plan that you can show that that's going to bring in that money, you can free up that general fund money and put it in other areas. So that has budget implications, you know, elsewhere. But I spoke with Senate Majority Leader Richerville just a few hours ago after session, and he said that they're really eyeing a July 4th deadline, you know, because he said previously he's not going to hold up their June 1st goal to get the budget done if they still don't have a deal in place for either the roads or Medicaid expansion. So if that happens, then I guess you'd have to go back and play with the budget, you know, which is doable. But I think that there is real consensus whether or not it's by the June 1st deadline or before the summer break that they really want to get this done.
Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. Chris, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you. Always glad to do it.
As the old saying goes, everything old is new again. Case in point, the cassette tape. Those of us who were music consumers in the 70s and the 80s remember those cassettes when they first arrived on the scene. So much smaller than those clunky 8-track tapes, and no skipping or gunk on the needles like your vinyl records. And then came the CD in the mid-80s, and after that the MP3. And the cassette tape came, for all intents and purposes, extinct. Or did it? The cassette tape is being revived, and a Michigan-based recording label called Already Dead Tapes is right out in front of this revival. Sean Hartman runs the label from Kalamazoo, along with his Chicago-based partner, Joshua Tabia. Sean Hartman joins us now from Kalamazoo. Hi, Sean.
Hey.
Okay, so I went through the cassette era. I remember, you know, carrying them in my car, and it was handy. You could play them in your car, and I remember making my own mixes, working from a dual tape unit that I had. And then CDs came into prominence, and I thought, I love this. I can jump right to the spot I want. No more fast forward and rewinding, trying to find the place. And then came MP3s, no skipping. So why are you and Joshua bringing cassettes back?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. For one, the cassette tapes are definitely right now a very niche market, and I don't see it ever becoming some sort of widely accepted popular format again. But some of the people within that niche market actually like it as a response to how accessible CDs and MP3s have become, especially with, you know, taking your iPod out and putting everything on shuffle. You lose some of the magic of actually just listening to an album start to finish.
The way that the artist and producer intended it to be listened to?
Exactly, as a full piece of art. And the cassette tape kind of forces you to take that whole package in, you know. You got to rewind it, and you listen to it from A to B.
This is true. No skipping forward.
Exactly. You know, for better or for worse, you're getting the album. And then another reason is that they're just they're very cheap to produce, and because cassette tapes have kind of been passed by the mainstream, you can, you know, go to thrift stores and find decks and units to, you know, make these tapes and get everything done at a much cheaper level. It's kind of, you can even find some in people's trash sometimes for free.
Can't play them in your car, though. That's a problem.
Well, no, the other thing actually is, you know, a lot of college students are buying old cars, and a lot of the cars that they can afford still have tape decks in them.
Okay, so they can play it. How are you doing this? Are you recording artists and then putting their stuff out on cassette?
All the stuff that's been sent to us so far has been recorded by the artist already. There's really no profit to speak of, so it's not like we can afford to pay an artist to record their album. It's all on a very do-it-yourself basis. They make a record that they want released, and then we help them a little bit by lending them some promotion. A lot of times we do the artwork for them and take care of the packaging, and then, you know, try and get it promoted on the internet and get them some extra fans via our website and the fan base that we've built up.
Are these college bands, or who are your artists?
There's a huge variety of bands that we put out on the label so far. We're at 74 releases, and we have releases from all across different genres and all across the world. Try to be a very international label. I mean, we've had, you know, folk releases, we've had straight jazz, we've had experimental, avant-garde, kind of more punk stuff, rock and roll, all over the place. And then we've done albums from Great Britain, from Russia, from Chile, done several albums from Greece now, a couple from Canada, and then all over the United States.
What do you get, Sean, out of finding these artists and being able to get their work out? I saw the term somewhere that you really want to help create a musical community.
Yeah. The label originally started as Josh Tabia's idea. He just wanted to have an extra outlet. You know, it can be tough playing music by yourself and trying to find other people that are interested. So part of that is wanting to reach out and find other artists similar to ourselves where we really enjoy their music, you know, enjoy their creative drive and want to help them, you know, get an extra step in getting their music out there and getting it appreciated by other people. So with that, yeah, we're not looking for people to make us famous. We're not looking for people to, you know, make a lot of money. It's all about people who just, you know, have a common interest and a common goal. So, yeah, there's definitely a community created there.
Now, do you only release on cassette or do you dabble in vinyl?
We have dabbled in vinyl. We'd like to do more vinyl once funding permits. So far, we've done 3 vinyl releases, done 2 full lengths and 1 7-inch.
Okay, I'm just curious, who is the typical cassette consumer? You say there are folks who want to kind of push back from MP3s and CDs. So who are those folks?
The modern cassette consumer for these like indie labels like us, I would say is generally more like early to mid-20s, like college age.
It's funny, those of us who thought that, oh my gracious, when that CD came, that's great, you know, it doesn't skip. Well, yeah, it would, actually. And then when the MP3s came, I think those of us who went through my 45s and my 33 and a third RPM albums, I wouldn't go back. I just love, you know, dragging things over in iTunes and making my own playlist. I remember how exhaustive it would be to make my mixtapes at home with my cassettes.
But again, there is a little bit of magic involved with making your own mixtape. You know, to make a mix on iTunes, it creates no effort. But if you're making a mixtape for someone special, it's nice to know that you actually sat down and put the effort into it and really worked on it. It makes it a little bit more special for both the person that created it and the person that's getting it.
That's pretty cool. And you were also planning, what, books and magazines and some visual arts as well?
Yeah, we have one comic book release that we just put out. Some friends of ours from Minneapolis did a collaboration on a sort of experimental artistic comic book release, and that's something we'd like to look into expanding to different mediums in the future, possibly some more books and poetry releases. And then we're talking to one of our artists about doing a video release as well. Actually, we're getting details together for that.
Sean Hartman runs Already Dead Tapes in Kalamazoo along with his Chicago-based partner, Josh Tabia, and their website is alreadydeadtapes.com. So keeping art alive, housed in those neat little plastic shells. Sean, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yep, thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.